This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're tuned in to the Evening Edition with Uma and Ezra. Now, you're probably familiar with the Malayan Emergency. It's a period that lasted 12 years, beginning in 1948 when three European estate managers were murdered in Perak. The Malayan National Liberation Army, which was the military arm of the Malayan Communist Party, they launched a guerrilla insurgency. It involved the infamous attacks on tin mines and rubber plantations, burning houses and buses, and derailing trains. Historians have cited various reasons for the conflict. There were difficult economic and social conditions after the war, and disaffection among the Chinese community towards unfulfilled promises of citizenship by the British. And as the conflict escalated, the British brought in external troops to fight alongside the Malayan Home Guard and the police. Support for the communists dwindled, and the emergency was declared to be over in July of 1960. Now, as with any historical event, it's not possible to paint the whole picture with a simple narrative. How did people fall on either side of the conflict? What was life like for the soldiers and for the average person on the street? On this Merdeka special program, we're featuring our conversation with historian Professor Emeritus Tan Sri Dr. Koo Kay Kim about the Malayan Emergency.
One of the things that I guess a lot of people sort of don't realize in this fight for independence, it's a lot more complex than just sort of Malayans, fighting for their independence. There were sort of a lot of cooperation with other different forces as well, other different elements. We want to talk a little bit more about that today. Maybe you can talk to us about the initial antagonists of the Malayan Emergency and how did that conflict begin?
This is a very complex problem. China's influence on Malaya in those days was very, very strong because so many Chinese migrated here. And actually, the rich Chinese of the Strait Settlements, Penang, Singapore in particular, were the ones who financially supported Dr. Sun Yat-sen when he decided to overthrow the Manchu regime. And so many of the Chinese in this country became members of the Kuomintang, the Nationalist Party. And as the years went by, more and more Chinese became members of the Kuomintang. And it became a bit difficult for the British to run the country because the British signed agreements with the Sultan, so they had duties towards Malay monarchies. And as a result of that, there were clashes, especially when Sun Yat-sen died. Before he died, he allowed the communists to join the Kuomintang.
There was a vacuum in leadership after he died?
No. His successor, Chiang Kai-shek, was anti-communist. So the fight started between the communists and the nationalists in China. It happened here too. And the British also took action against the communists. But because the communists had become members of the Kuomintang, so the British banned the Kuomintang here in 1925. But later on, when the emergency was declared, the British found that the people they could really trust to fight the communists were members of the Kuomintang. And so they had to work with members of the Kuomintang. So the whole situation was very complicated.
So, Prof, let's talk about the Commonwealth Armed Forces and, I guess, the fight during the Malayan Emergency. What were the conditions in which the British required external armies to come in and help them?
Again, you see, from the very beginning, the Malay states were protectorates. They said the British colonized the Malay states. They did not. The Malay states were protectorates. They came under British protection. So, even after the war, especially after the war, when the British were already prepared to withdraw, they found that the Communist Party was practically in control of Malaya. So they said that would not do. They had a duty towards the Malay states. they must crush the Communist Party before they withdrew. And that's what they did, you see. And in order to do that, they brought in soldiers from what was called the British Empire, from Africa, from Australia, from Nepal, from New Zealand. The whole situation was very interesting. And there's something I would like to tell you about that. Because many years ago, an Australian scholar came and asked me, he said, what was the situation like here during the emergency? Was it anything like what happened in Vietnam during the Vietnam War? Then I laughed. I say, if you had made a study of the history of sports in this country, you will find that the peak period was during the emergency. They brought Africans, they brought Fijians. The Fijians were such fantastic rugby players. In 1950 or 51, when Malaya played against Thailand rugby, Malaya beat Thailand 49-0. Malaya had never beaten Thailand in rugby. But in 1950 or 51, Malaya fielded 6 Fijians. And several of these Fijians were also very good in athletics. The 2 fastest men in Malaya at that time were 2 brothers. And there was also a boxer called Radroro. He became the light heavyweight champion of Malaya. And he captained the rugby team. You see? The Africans, in athletics, won all the events from 1,500 meters to marathon. You see? And so Malaysians were also taken up with sports. Even the Chinese new villages had inter-village basketball competition. So if you compare the situation during emergency with today, you will be surprised how people were so taken up with sports. Today, well, you don't even find league matches in the towns anymore. Those days, the people had no time for the communists. They were so taken up with sports. And the schools too. All headmasters had to give priority to sports. So I grew up in an excellent environment. And the emergency was nothing.
So could the emergency have taken place, in surrounding areas, but as you mentioned, people were just living their lives and not be aware of it?
No, they were very aware of it, especially the Chinese. The Chinese were always very aware of themselves. See? But what they knew, others did not really know. See? For example, non-Chinese would not know that among the Chinese, those who were communists were mainly Hainanese and Hakka. The Hokkiens were the rich people in this country. They never supported communism. And in fact, the Communist Party in Malaya was founded by the Hainanese rubber tappers of Sungai Ujung in Kuala Pila in 1930. And unless you really take the trouble to get to know the society, you will not know how they behave. You see, culture is something very, very different between one group and another. And even among the Indians, for example, the people who were more inclined towards the left were Malayalis. So that when the British allowed the Pan-Malayan Federation of Trade Unions to come into existence, they picked P.P. Narayanan to head the union. Why P.P. Narayanan? And Narayanan must be a Malayali. See, and among the Chinese, because the Hainanese were very involved, when the British set up the Psychological Warfare Department, they picked CC2 to head. Why CC2? 2 must be a Hainanese. Like Ku must be a Hokkien. Those days, our names were all based on the dialects. So you could tell whether Hokkien or Cantonese or Hakka. Today is more based on Mandarin, so you can't tell anymore unless the name is written down.
More after this with Professor Koo Kay Kim, where he recounts the bravery of the Gurkha soldiers as well as communist propaganda in schools. Stay tuned to the evening edition on BFM 89.9.
bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to the Evening Edition with Uma and Ezra. Today, we've been looking back at an important event in our history, and that's the Malayan Emergency. It lasted from 1948 to 1960. Now, for a flash from the past, here's Sir Gerald Templer, British High Commissioner in Malaya at the time, with his speech.
You've asked me to say something of our aims in Malaya today. Just as in Korea and in Indochina, the menace of communism has manifested itself in armed aggression and has attempted, unsuccessfully, to throttle the economy of the country. It's failed abysmally because of the loyalty of the vast majority of technicians and laborers of the essential services and industries. The shooting isn't over yet, by any means, but daily more and more people are becoming less frightened to support the government. We're trying, therefore, to turn our attention more and more to the social services, to education, and to the political development to which the people are entitled. On this structure, we are trying to build the foundation of a sound local administration, which will be the basis of a united and self-governing Malayan nation.
Our guest today is Professor Koo Kay Kim. We met him in his office at the University of Malaya to recount the conflict as well as life during the Malayan Emergency.
Prof, talk to us about the Malayan Home Guard. What was their role at the time and what were some of the difficulties that they faced?
Because they were not trained soldiers. You see? And among the Chinese...
They were volunteers?
They were recruited. You see? But among the Chinese, at that time, they never encouraged young Chinese boys to become soldiers. The Chinese saying then was, good iron is not made into nails, good boys never become soldiers. See? That's the Chinese saying, you see. So, for example, when the British introduced conscription sometime in 1950-51, so many young Chinese left Malaya and returned to China. But then they couldn't fit into China because China had become communist since 1949. So after a while, they wanted to come back. By that time, Tunku Abdul Rahman was the chief minister. And when he was told that these people wanted to come back, he allowed them to come back. Tunku was like that. He was such a nice man. You see?
So, Prof, of all the different contributions from these different soldiers from the Commonwealth, the Gurkhas played a key role. And that's something at least I think a lot of people can still acknowledge. And why was their role so significant? And what was it about them and their training, perhaps?
Yeah, because they were so unlike other soldiers because of the culture. In their society, the best way for a person to die was to die fighting, especially defending his country. So whenever they fought, they wanted to die. Their opponents did not want to die. So it's a terrible disadvantage when you fight against somebody who wants to die. And they were very, very brave. Today, of course, they are still around, but they are called Nepalis. There are many security guards. In those days, people who wanted to ensure safety. For example, the presidential residence in Singapore was guarded by Gurkhas. And then in Brunei, after the uprising in 1962, the Sultan also used Gurkhas to look after his istana. So everywhere they were trusted, respected, and praised so much by the people, see, because they were honest and they would risk their lives to carry out their duties. The British found that out when they were conquering India. And then when they reached Nepal, they found that the people were so different. See. And instead of conquering Nepal, they befriended Nepal. And they made use of Nepalese soldiers. And the group that used to be soldiers were called Gurkhas. But today, of course, they don't talk about Gurkhas, they talk about Nepalis. I was in a train ambush once, yeah? And the British soldiers also were in the train, and they tried to shoot back at bandits. But the Gurkhas who were also there thought differently. They felt that it would be dangerous for the passengers if they were to fight the communists from inside. They jumped out of the train and charged. And the communists ran for their lives.
Prof, tell me this. Earlier you mentioned that there was a divide between, I guess, the fight that was going on in the jungle and urban Malayans. Did urban Malayans see this as their fight? I mean, in schools, was there a lot of anti-communist propaganda?
No.
No?
No. The Chinese schools, for example, were quite free in those for many, many years. And many of the teachers came from China. So they used to discreetly influence their pupils. I know because I went to the English school in the morning and I went to a Chinese school in the afternoon. It's the same school, but we have English in the morning, Chinese in the afternoon, but different administrators. And I had one teacher who was a communist. I found her later. But I remember how he used to teach. He used to condemn the British. He used to praise the Chinese. And he was very, very modern in his ideas. I once answered a question and I said something about using a Chinese word, you see? And he corrected me. He said, China is today a republic. You don't talk of... I think I use the term kingdom in Chinese. You don't talk of kingdom anymore. He was quite kind, but very, very political in his approach. And then later on, I found out how Xi Jinping became a communist. He was converted by his teacher in the Chinese school. Mm.
And what about the Malays and the Indians? Where did they fall in?
They went to separate schools.
But in terms of their sort of being exposed to communism?
Not at all. At all. Because among the Indians, as I said, only the Malays were more inclined towards the left. But all the schools were Tamil schools. There were maybe a handful of Malayalam school, but not hardly. And certainly among the Malays, Malay schools were all controlled by the British. But even the Japanese kept the Malay schools going during the Japanese occupation. All the other schools were closed down, but Malay schools continued. And the British from the beginning of the 20th century, trained Malay teachers for Malay schools. And by 1922, they established the Sultan Idris Training College in Tanjung Malaya.
But of course, you know, that communist influence went beyond the Chinese community. And
it did not. See, when the Communist Party was formed, the Communist International directed the party to concentrate on the Malays, convert the Malays. But that party, from day one, use the Chinese language for communication. So their motto, their slogan, was always said in Chinese, Kung Chan Tang, Wan Sui. So the non-Chinese found it very difficult.
They had no chance to relate. And
they could not communicate. And their pamphlets were all in Chinese. So very Chinese.
Yeah, that's why there were only a handful of, I guess, Malay members of the Communist Party, and all of them were fluent in the language.
And many of these were already converted when they were in Sumatra. See, in Indonesia, Sumatra, the Sumatrans somehow were more inclined towards the left. For example, the leftist Malay Party, which was formed in Ipoh at the end of 1945, In English, it's always called the Malay Nationalist Party. So people always thought that that's the real Nationalist Party. But in Malay, it sounded very different because it was called Partai. See, the word Partai was not a Malay word, you see. Partai Kebangsaan Melayu Malaya. The Malays never use Malaya. They always say Tanah Melayu because Malaya means land of the Malays. And the founder of that party, his name was Mukhtarudin Lasso. Again, not a Malay, of Sumatran origin. Yeah. And it was founded in Ipoh, a Chinese town. So very few of the Malays were involved, but those who were involved were mostly of Sumatran origin.
We're featuring Professor Koo K. Kim on our Merdeka special program today about the Malayan emergency. More after this, where we talk about jungle warfare at the time, as well as his take on history and facts among Malaysians today. Stay tuned with us on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Because freedom matters. BFM 89.9.
You're with Uma and Ezra on the Evening Edition, and today we've been featuring our special program to celebrate 60 years of Merdeka by taking a look back at the Malayan emergency. It was a defining moment for the country that spanned the years before and after independence. Our guest is Professor Koo K. Kim, and we're delving right back into the history about the emergency.
The key thing was, of course, that sort of jungle warfare of being able to navigate the tropical forests. And arguably the communists held an upper hand in terms of that sort of local knowledge and the topography and the geography of the land in comparison to somebody like the soldier that I spoke to as a foreign Australian soldier. How did the Commonwealth forces deal with that aspect?
Well, they had difficulties, but the Commonwealth soldiers were not alone, you see. We have to remember that there were Gurkhas and there were locals too, you see, who were involved. So whenever there was a battle, it depends on who were fighting the communists. You see. You take, for example, one instance when the Fijians went to the jungle to look for the communists, and there was a battle. Then the Fijians felt that somebody had to be sent back to the nearest police station to get help. And it so happened that one of them was a very famous rugby player called Rokua. So they told him to run back to the police station. So he ran, and the communists tried to shoot him. They couldn't. He was like playing rugby. And he went back and he brought assistance, and they defeated the communists. And then there were even Chinese who were, you think, for example, one group of Chinese were really very, very anti-communist. They were called Kongsai Chinese, found mostly in Lenggung in Upper Perak. And Colonel H.S. Lee, who was one of the anti-communist Kuomintang, right? Worked with Henry Gurney, Sir Henry Gurney, the governor, to establish what was called the Kinta Valley Home Guards. They were fantastic fighters. And the communists were so afraid of them.
Yes. Why did they stand apart, Prof? Were they military trained? What made them different? Because you said that, you know, Chinese boys didn't join the army.
Because the Kongsai people hated the communists. They were also very strong Kuomintang supporters. And another group of people, the British were very lucky there. Another group of Chinese who were very anti-communist were the secret societies. You see, the secret societies had supported Dr. Sun Yat-sen when he fought the Manchu regime, and they remained loyal to the Kuomintang. So the British did not have to worry about the secret societies. So in the town areas especially, the secret societies took the side of the British against the communists.
Prof, what do you think were some of the factors that led to the success of the capitalist forces in the end when it comes to this particular engagement?
The support of the majority of the people. It's not just capitalist forces, but as I said, among the Chinese, the majority were Kuomintang supporters, even secret societies. Among the Indians, the Tamils were not prone towards communism. There were Malayalis, but few. Okay? And among the Malays, only those of Sumatran origin were more inclined towards the communists. The majority were very loyal to their rulers. And then the country was so prosperous, even before the war especially. Then during the war, of course, they all suffered because of the Japanese. And they were very angry with the Japanese. After the end of the war, they expected peace. And these communists came and caused trouble. So the talk among the Chinese in general was that they should support the British against the communists. And also, in this country, so many Chinese were millionaires. How could they ever come to terms with the Communist Party? Never.
You know, it's 60 years of Merdeka this year, and I think we have a very terrible habit of either disproportionately glorifying certain elements and not acknowledging certain parts of what has brought us here. On both of those two points, where do you think we have fallen short on either point?
I think the sad part is most Malaysians do not know what happened in the past. So there is a lot of coffee shop talk. And then there are some young people who just imagine things. And they come up with very funny stories, completely untrue. So it is very important that the children should be properly educated. You see. If there is any doubt, one must always fall back on evidence. And we have so much evidence. There are sources on this country's history, in Singapore, in London, in Amsterdam, in Lisbon.
Are there some in Malaysia?
There are, but people are not aware where these sources are. For example, how many people know that in Batu Gajah you have a lot of the Kinta District Office files? How many people know that Taiping today has an archive of its own? And that in Johor Bahru also, there is a very good archive. But you take, for example, the case of the Japanese occupation. The Japanese ruled Malaya from Taiwan because they had conquered Taiwan already. So they ruled Malaya from Taiwan. So today, there are lots of Japanese administrative records in Taiwan. I have tried to encourage people to learn Japanese to go there and look at these records. Nothing has happened. It was unlike the 50s and the 60s when many young historians were very proactive. They were very keen to come up with a different version of Malaysian history, not Eurocentric, but what we call Malayan-centric. So we worked very hard. You look at some of my students' essays, I made them write. On top there, again, a whole lot. I made them write. I didn't want them to use published sources. I told them to talk to people, interview old people, and study about their own kampungs, and they came up with all this.
Prof, one last thing, Prof, because it's 60 years of Merdeka, and I think the further away we get from that date, the weight and importance of it begins to become quieter, softer. We forget, right?
Yes.
And I was wondering from your point of view, from your perspective, could you just, remind us as to what it was like in 1957, the weight of that day and what it meant?
I always go back to the period before the war because so much of what happened after the war was actually a continuation of what was already happening before the war. You take, for example, some of these quarrels among the people of different ethnic groups already started before the war. And then the situation here was so complicated. Many people don't even understand that the Malay Peninsula was unofficially called Malaya. So when you use the term Malaya, you have to be very careful with it. Because sometimes Singapore was included, sometimes it was not. The only time when the whole lot were included was whenever sports took place. For example, the first all-Malaya lawn tennis championship was introduced in 1922, and that included Singapore. Okay. Although Singapore was separate most of the time, in 1949, when our badminton team went to play in the first Thomas Cup competition in England, Singapore players were included. But earlier, 1 year earlier, in 1948, Singapore was able to send its own athletes to the Olympic Games in London because it had formed the Olympic Council in 1947. Singapore did not include Malays. And Malaya could not go to even the Helsinki in 1982 because our Olympic Council was formally in 1953. But we went to the Olympics at Melbourne in 1956. We were not yet a nation state. So complicated. So it would take a long time to get the young people to understand all that. But unless you emphasize history in the school, and history and geography. Because if you don't include geography, you talk about Singapore, Melaka, Penang, they'll be wondering where these places are.
That was historian Professor Emeritus Tan Sri Dr. Koo Kee Kim. Next on our Merdeka special program, we're featuring an Australian veteran soldier who fought in the Malayan emergency against the communists as part of the Commonwealth troops sent by the British. Stay tuned with us on the evening edition, BFM 89.9.
Be free-minded. BFM 89.9.
You're with Uma and Ezra on the evening edition, and today we've been featuring our Merdeka special program. Now we're going to hear from a veteran soldier who fought in the Malayan emergency. His name is William Cruz. He was an Australian soldier sent to Malaya to fight against the communist guerrilla force.
Well, it's William Richard Cruz. I was in the Australian Army during the conflict in Malaya. I was in there from 1959 to 1962.
William signed up to the Australian Army at the age of 21 and was posted to Malaya in 1959 as part of the 28th Commonwealth Infantry Brigade Group. They were made up of soldiers from Britain, Australia and New Zealand.
Well, our mission was to curtail the activities of the communist terrorist element within the Malaya. Our job was to seek out any communist terrorists and curtail their operations. Xing Ping and his guerrilla forces, yes, are very, very, very active. We had to search all people, like even in people with push bikes, because they used to hide food in amongst their containers on their bicycles, etc., you know. That was the sympathisers. They started off a lot in Sungi Suput, but then they were sort of curtailed and pushed towards the inland and towards the Thai border. We worked from the south to the north to clear the country as it went. I served in Ipoh, Taiping, even in Penang, and eventually, once the communist element had been worked up to north of the border where we used to still operations, we moved down to Turandot Camp in Malacca.
It sounds like, you know, as you speak about some of these places, that the geography and the topography of the land, it sounds still very familiar and still very close to you.
Oh, yes, I know it very well. My wife, in fact, comes from Malaya. I met her in Taiping, actually. She was working in Taiping. Then we married in Turandot Camp in Malacca in 1962.
Soldiers like William had to take the fight to the Malayan tropical jungles because that was where the communists were camped, and that's also where they received food and support from communist sympathizers.
You don't talk in the jungle operations much because it's all hand signals, and you don't wash, so you're pretty dirty and grubby by the time you finish operations.
I don't mean to be, I guess, facetious with the question, but did you ever feel that your life was in grave threat or was in constant threat?
Well, you do that at all times. That's part and parcel of the duties to perform. You never know what's around the corner. You're on edge and standby all the time. But, you know, once you join the army, especially regular army, you know what your duty is and you know the problems that can happen and circumstances you get involved in. Naturally, doesn't matter where you serve in the army, when you're up against another force, you can get a copper bullet any time. So, you know, it's just part and parcel of your duties.
And so the Malayan emergency was pronounced to be over June 1960. And
They had a big parade in Kuala Lumpur.
In the capital of the Federation, Premier Tunku Abdul Rahman reads and signs a most welcome proclamation. It officially ends the Malayan emergency after a bitter 12-year jungle conflict with the communists. The Royal Malay Regiment, heading the parade, marched past the Yang Tipatuan Agong, the king, in Kuala Lumpur. This was in celebration of the ending of the so-called emergency. Malay police were in the march.
Oh, it was big. It was every elements of every force that served over there. There was other forces served, not at my time, in my time, but like I think it was Indian. There was a few other ones, but everybody had took part in the big procession in Kuala Lumpur. It was very big, yes.
The 1st Battalion, the Royal Australian Regiment.
And what did you continue to do back in Australia after you went back? And what was it like assimilating back into, I guess, civilian life?
Well, I didn't assimilate back in the civilian life. I stayed in the army till 1975. I was in Vietnam from 1966 to 1967.
Wow. Yeah, and it just continued for you, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I was regular army. So I served 20 years in the Australian army.
That's pretty remarkable, William. And of course, do you feel as, you know, sort of an Australian soldier and given your efforts in Malaya, do you think you and your fellow soldiers received a commensurate level of recognition for your efforts here?
Yes, I think so. We did. They were very generous to us. They were happy that we'd given their help to free their country. I think the people in Malaya appreciated what we'd done. This was more so than what we did in Vietnam. When we came back here, we got a very poor reception from our own people. A lot of people are very, or exiles are very unhappy about the way we were treated when we came back from Vietnam. We were spat on and called murderers and things of that nature from your own people. That's pretty hard to take.
William has been back to Peninsula Malaysia on several occasions, and as he recounts, many changes have taken place over the decades.
My wife still has family there, and we often go to see them in KL or other part of our family lives up around Ipoh. I've been over there quite a few times.
The country's changed quite a bit, I imagine, from the days when you were here as a young soldier.
Oh, yeah, hasn't it ever, you know. It's gone ahead by leaps and bounds, yes. If you saw it back when I first saw it, it's so different, yeah.
Well, I mean, there are parts of Malaysia right now, William, when I travel, and, you know, I'm up north, especially closer towards Kelantan in the East Coast, perhaps, which is where my family's from. It's a little bit underdeveloped, and, you know, it still feels like the vibe of the jungle is still very, very strong. But, yeah, you know, for the rest of
Peninsula Malaysia, most of it has been quite developed since you were here.
Yes, and probably on the east coast, on the west coast, it's all vibrant, right up to Langkawi, up to there. See, I can even remember when the only transport to Penang was the ferry.
That's right.
There was no bridge there at all.
William, I guess, you know, there aren't many left like you, you know, who sort of fought in Malaya for our independence. And, you know, what we've been trying to do is always trying to capture these voices. And have you had conversations with any of your contemporaries, or is that something that you just don't do now anymore?
Well, you know, I suppose once you're finished in the services, you keep contact with some people. But then again, I suppose there's a lot of the people that served over there at that time that have passed on. Not a lot of them around these days. Over the years, they've just passed on.
William, I guess, you know, when you came here to Malaya at the age of 21, you probably, probably in your mid to late 20s by the time you left, and you've spoken about the word duty quite a number of times. Do you remember what duty meant at the time when you were serving and what it meant later once you retired?
Well, duty was what you was expected of you as a member of the forces, and you carried out the duties that you were assigned to. Now I get out and I've got about 10 medals, and you sort of have a sense of pride when you have your different functions and ceremonies where you wear your medals, and you know that you've put in your service for your country.
And I guess it makes a difference, right?
Yes, I feel proud. I feel proud that I've served. Very proud.
It sounds like a rare honor that many don't get to experience, and it's been my pleasure to be able to speak to William. So thank you very much for your time. I very much appreciate it, and thank you very much for your service.
It's my pleasure to speak to you. It's great to be able to speak to someone and just let them know what we did and the fact that your country should appreciate what we've done.
That was William Cruz, a former soldier in the Australian Army who fought here in the Malayan Emergency. And if you missed any part of this program, or if you'd simply like to share a piece of Malaysian history with a friend, you can download the podcast on our BFM 89.9 app, and that's available on the Apple App Store and on Google Play. You've been listening to The Evening Edition. I'm Ezra Zayed for BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.